are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Everything's on the Table, a weekly program where we ask, what is the recipe for the future of food in New York City? Each week, we examine the food policies impacting our everyday lives and what hangs in the balance as New Yorkers go to the polls this fall. We'll look at what's happening now and what the next administration can do to support a healthier, more sustainable, and fair city.
All right. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Everything's on the Table. I'm your co-host, Erin Fairbanks, and today we are talking health. I'm joined in the studio by Carolyn Zezima. Carolyn, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thanks. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So Carolyn's going to be our co-host today, taking us through the landscape of health and how we should be thinking about it prior to the upcoming mayoral election this November. Carolyn is president of NYC Foodscape, which is a food systems and urban agriculture consulting business and blog. You can find out more about her work by visiting www.nycfoodscape.com. For the past 9 years, she has led and worked with food and farming organizations in Chicago and New York to promote urban agriculture and healthy food systems. She served as director of food and nutrition initiatives for Communities Impact Diabetes Center at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, addressing food and nutrition issues affecting diabetes disparities in low-income communities, and overseeing food initiatives such as the Food for Health Business Plan Competition and the Save Half for Later Portion Control Initiative. I could go on and on. Your work is extensive, but I want to get into the topic at hand today, which is health. So maybe you can kind of help us set the stage for our discussion.
Sure. First of all, I want to thank Heritage Radio for partnering with the Food Systems Network on this exciting series. I've been listening to the episodes so far, and you and the other hosts have done a great job of bringing voters the food systems issues that hang in the balance. And today we're going to talk about the role of public health and food, the connection. I wanted to start with a quote from an article I read on Civil Eats by Roots of Change President Michael Dimock, entitled, Can Public Health Unite the Good Food Movement? The article starts with a discussion about how significant changes to our farm bill tend to occur as a reaction to crises, and that the food movement itself is often a confluence of many interests that tend to respond tactically to bad policy and the effects of industrial food production. You know, anti-hunger organizations, environmental, food justice, buy local labor, et cetera, school food, obviously. But he goes on to say that there is a way to coordinate actions that would hugely expand public support for the movement's policy goals to create a food system strategy and farm bill strategy that solves rather than creates problems. So the quote is, for the food movement to place unstoppable pressure on policymakers and industrial food producers, it needs a very focused set of goals that emerge from a single root crisis that binds us all. Mm. Public health is that crisis. I believe that all strands of the movement are, at their core, responding to current or potential health threats. Through a strategic focus on improved health, we can lower resistance to those in control of the industrial system and motivate action from the millions of people we need with us. Public health advocates are the food movement's most important allies.
That's very powerful. I think it's going to be interesting today to kind of go through with a number of our guests on kind of how we make some of this a reality.
But just before we get to our first guest, I wanted to note that, you know, New York City is doing a pretty good job on the public health front overall. Mayor Bloomberg has become known as a kind of a health mayor. And the mayor and the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene has started to get the connection, has certainly gotten the connection between food and public health, and have started or even attempted to start some very good, sometimes controversial issues to combat food-related illness and access and grant greater access to healthier food. Much of the mayor's focus has been on discouraging the promotion of unhealthy, meaning high-fat, sugar, salt, and food with a lot of salt, such as his requiring chain restaurants to post calorie counts on menus, banning the trans fats at restaurants, the city's national salt reduction initiative, and his recently attempted large-size soda ban. And these efforts actually can help people, nudge people in the right direction, but they're not the only way to increase food access and change healthy lifestyles. And so it's really, I'm going to turn to Devin Madden in a moment, our first guest from the Partnership for Healthy in New York City, who really, I think, is going to connect the idea that it's our communities, our schools, and our work sites, in essence, the policy systems and environments in which we live and function every day, that are the hard to regulate, but often most have the most direct impact on our ability to maintain a healthy lifestyle. And that public health can have a large role in creating environments that bring greater access to healthier food and lifestyle choices through partnering with community-based organizations and individuals. So, Devin, welcome.
Hi.
I'm glad to have you.
I'm so glad to be here.
I know Devin from my days at Mount Sinai. Devin is the project manager in the Department of Health Evidence and Policy at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and she is the coordinator of the Manhattan Coalition of the Partnership for Healthier NYC. As that coordinator, she has convened and manages a very large borough-wide coalition of over 100 members, community members, organizations, and stakeholders to work together to address the leading causes of death and disease in our communities, including lack of access to healthy food and lack of physical activity. She'll go on, we'll find out more about what she's working on, but she's been a consultant on various other Department of Health and Mental Hygiene initiatives, including the Nutrition and Obesity Study. She's received a Master of Public Health from Southern Connecticut State University, where she is now an adjunct faculty member in public health. So, again, welcome.
Thank you.
So why don't you just kind of define, what is the Partnership for Healthier New York City, and what is its genesis, in essence, relationship to the work of the New York City's Department of Health and Mental Hygiene?
Right. So the Partnership for Healthier New York City, which I'll refer to as the Partnership, is a citywide entity that's goal really is the reduction of chronic disease for all New Yorkers. So regardless of income, regardless of education, we're looking at all New Yorkers and trying to improve their health outcomes through supporting proven community-level efforts that shift environments in which we make choices every day of our lives, right? And your question about how we're connected to the Department of Health and what our genesis is that we were actually born out of a community transformation grant that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention put out a couple of years ago. These grants are happening all across the country. And New York City received a grant through the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene to do this work with communities across the three leading causes of death. And so they created a new organization or entity called the Partnership to get on the ground, work with communities, and get this stuff up and running. One organization from each of the five boroughs was selected to sort of lead the charge with the communities in their neighborhoods and also come together on a citywide level. And so Mount Sinai was selected for Manhattan, and so that's sort of what I'm doing. So yes, we are born out of a grant that was given to the Department of Health. We work very closely with the Department of Health for field support, data, you know, vetting strategies, but we also work very closely with the community. So we have this great relationship where we're with DOH, but we're also with the community.
Can you actually talk a little bit about the approach that the partnership uses towards improving public health, specifically maybe this idea of policy systems and environmental change and how it might differ from programmatic on the ground
work? Sure. Yeah. So first and foremost, I want to say that we recognize that our health choices are not made in silos, right? We are individuals, yes, but we're operating in a system or an environment in which we make health choices. So I want to stress that we do think programming is really important because we need to get that knowledge base up for people in the community. But what's the sense in having a program and helping people build their skills and their knowledge if they're going to go out into a community to try to make choices in a community that is oppositional to everything that they've learned? So they're still going to be bombarded by marketing and, you know, just the healthy choices and the unhealthy choices and the saturation of those unhealthy choices. So we need to be working at a systems and environmental level so that we can help people make the healthy choice. And the other thing that I want to say is that our approach really does rely on the community input and the community advice and the community wisdom. Yes, we are working on evidence-based evidence-based strategies, which means that they've been vetted by public health researchers, that there is some backing to them. We're not just nilly-willy thinking, oh, we're just going to throw the strategy out into the world and see if it works. Unfortunately, we don't have all of the dollars for evaluation, although we are working to evaluate our work on the level that we're doing it. But we need to take the strategies that are out there that are working and tailor them to our communities. So one example that I can think of is when we're talking about healthy foods with our communities, we've heard that we don't want to hear about obesity, right? We don't want to use that word all of the time. It doesn't always work. So as we're working, and we can talk a little bit more about this later, but in the food retail setting, to get some of these educational messages out to communities where they're at, we'll use words like health or energy or something that resonates with the community at a different level. So that's sort of what our approach is.
Wow, that's really actually a very interesting approach. What are your specific priorities that you're working on around healthy food?
So there's a couple of things that we're working on around healthy food. I'd say that each borough coalition has a little bit of a different strategy, again, based on what their communities want and what their coalitions are saying is needed in the community. So we're all doing something that's a little bit different, but we definitely have a shared goal, and that goal is really to increase the availability of and the promotion of healthy foods and beverages while decreasing the availability and promotion of the unhealthy. And so a couple of ways that we're doing that is, you know, there is a huge discussion happening right now around access. And we have done consumer surveys. I'll speak to Manhattan for a second specifically. We've done consumer surveys with over 1,000, you know, community members living in Harlem, living in Washington Heights and Inwood, and with the help of our partners at Cloth, the Community League of the Heights, and in the Lower East Side. And people are shopping in grocery stores. We know that this is where people are going. So wouldn't it be great if the grocery store itself, the supermarket where people are going to get their foods, can be a messenger of health? So we're working to try to translate the messages that a lot of our community-based organizations that we've been working with have been getting out into the community already, bringing them into the grocery store where you're going to meet and reach everybody, because everybody at some point in their day, in their week, in their month, is going to be going through the grocery store.
So what do you think the grocery stores, they're currently, if they're not currently a messenger of health, what are they a messenger of right now?
We see, and what we've seen through the surveys, is that people don't necessarily know how to make the healthy decision when they're in the grocery store. And if we go into some of the grocery stores in the neighborhoods that we're really concentrating on, the produce doesn't look that great. There will be heart-healthy signs next to Fruit Loops or cereals that are definitely not heart-healthy. It can be an incredibly complicated system to navigate. And then you get to the checkout aisle, right? And, oh, there's my candy bars. I'm just going to grab that. So how do we promote the healthy foods and help people make the healthy decisions? How do we make sure that produce is getting rotated, that grocery store managers and the people on the ground working there know what to do with the produce so that it looks fresh and so that it is fresh? And how do we get also those shelf talkers and that information with what actually is healthy, what you should be choosing? This is how you could make this recipe into those stores. Because while it's happening in some grocery stores across the city, it's definitely inequitable.
Devin, I wanted to ask you, how did you get these grocery stores to sign on? Like, who did the legwork?
Our youth are amazing. So we have a great partnership with MACHO, which is Motivating Action Through Community Health Outreach, and their youth leadership program. So we were able, through our coalition, to start a youth action network. And this was really a great way for them, for youth, to get comfortable, get the skills to say, we can go into places in our neighborhoods and say, we want change. We want the healthy foods. The demand is there. Can you promote this? So a group of students from the borough went out one night, two nights, a couple nights, and they basically introduced themselves, said, this is our mission. Do you care about the health of your communities? We got a couple of no's, not going to lie. A lot of people were hesitant to sign the pledge. And the pledge was something that had been working in Washington Heights and Inwood. It came out of the Choosing Healthy and Active Lifestyles for Kids program that New York Presbyterian and Columbia had. they had seen tremendous success for it in Washington Heights. It was developed by community. So we thought, let's bring it down to Harlem, to the Lower East Side, to different neighborhoods across Manhattan. They went out, they asked, and a couple of people said, yeah, let's sign the pledge. And so for the past, since January, we've really been working with the grocery store managers to build up the relationship, because Rome isn't built in a day, and there's a lot of money in marketing unhealthy foods, unfortunately. And there's a lot of changes that we're trying to get them to make. So it's a slow process, but they are on board and moving forward with us.
I think we have time for one more question in this segment, and then we're going to go to a quick break. But
Well, I did want to hear a little bit more about the youth aspect. I know that you're also working with other organizations that work in other various aspects of the food system. One of them is Harlem Seed. You work in urban agriculture as well. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing on that front? We are going to have a episode in the very near. The next episode is going to focus on urban agriculture and youth. But I know that the Mayor's Obesity Task Force report that came out last year specifically recommended that the New York City Housing Authority create urban farms, and that there be at least 15 more community garden sites. So I thought that.
So I think a couple of things, and I'll try to be quick, but, you know, with youth are an important messenger of health. They're important agents of change. They're important drivers. Harlem Seeds does tremendous work teaching youth how to cook and getting them sort of immersed in what it means to grow food. We've seen tremendous success. This is a little bit separate, but with the Bronx Coalition from Bronx Health Reach, in engaging youth around bodega snacks. So we've seen this transition towards youth, and or not a transition, but this activation of youth to get involved in the food movement, and it's amazing. Towards urban agriculture and towards that end, you know, there's a lot of naysayers still in New York City who are like, it's not going to solve the food problem. It is not going to feed all New Yorkers. We cannot grow carrots and give them to all 8 million of us, right? And we aren't saying that we can, but we are saying that there is potential for urban agriculture across all 5 of the boroughs. So our coalition is in the process of building a toolkit that explores the potential for urban ag and the different benefits of urban ag in addressing the foodscape in general. That we're getting started working on. We've been working on for the past couple of months, and we're really delving into right now.
Specifically in Manhattan.
Specifically for Manhattan, because a lot of people are like, there's no land, what are we going to do, the air, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, these are all legitimate concerns, but people have been successful, and we can learn lessons from those people.
All right. I'm bummed, but we'll have to move to a quick break, and we'll be back shortly. You're listening to Everything's on the Table. What's the recipe for the future of food in New York City? Hang tight. We'll be right back.
You are listening to Dirty Hands by Eula on the heritageradionetwork.org. Listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us, and enjoy the show.
You don't think you can do something about the war in Afghanistan or climate change? Get involved in the food movement. You can make somebody's life much better. People ask me, well, where should we start? I say start with schools. What's going on in schools is incredible. mean, it isn't only the federal changes that have been made. It's on the ground, people who are cooking in schools and making healthier foods for kids. If you change the diets at schools and get kids interested in cooking and kids interested in what they're eating, those kids are going to grow up to be healthier adults. I mean, those are important changes. So I'm enormously optimistic about the possibility for making change. The challenge is to make that change reach the people who need it most. That's a big challenge. But it's not going to happen if you don't start someplace.
All right. That was a quick quote from Marion Nessel, kind of leading the way in the fight for good food. And we want to talk a little bit more in the second segment about kids and working with kids and feeding kids. And we're in the studio here with Bruce Simon. He's a parent, the student at Edward R. Monroe High School, and a history of working in different retail and food environments. Bruce, welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So, as a parent feeding a young child, you know, what challenges that you face, especially when you're sending your daughter off to school?
A lot of the cafeterias in school don't offer choices. My daughter chose to be a vegetarian when she was about 5 or 6 years old. So, in addition to really looking for less processed, less canned things, we're also looking for more vegetarian options. You know, fresh vegetables and salad bars and. They're kind of hard to find.
And is she kind of asking you for different food options? I mean, what is she expressing, kind of what she's looking for, wishes that she would see in the school?
We kind of send lunch with her every day at this point. You know, some cheese and some fruit and some Clif bars and, you know, macaroni and cheese that's more natural and organic that she kind of eats at lunchtime.
So I want to talk a little bit more about some of the resources that are out there to help parents get engaged with what their kids are eating in school. And Carolyn, maybe I'll let you introduce our other guest here in the studio.
Yes, I'm very glad to have both Bruce here, who knows our next guest as well, has been working with her. Deborah Lewis Grant is the co-founder of Food Fight, which is an educational nonprofit whose mission is to revolutionize the way we eat and think about food. Using schools as a platform, Food Fight arms teachers, staffs, parents, and students with the tools and knowledge they need to make healthier choices and become role models and agents for change for their families and communities. Deborah graduated from Teachers College at Columbia University with a dual master's degree in deaf education and English, and later, after teaching at several New York City public schools, she got her doctorate from Columbia in curriculum and teaching with a focus on student-teacher interactions in the classroom. So, obviously, your nonprofit is stemming out of that experience. Before, I want to go back to Bruce for 1 second. How did you find out about Food Fight, and what has been your involvement so far?
Food Fight presented a workshop at the Murrow High School where parents and teachers were invited, and I was fortunate enough to attend, and I found the message and the information that they were sharing and trying to get out brilliant, and just really trying to increase people's awareness of what they eat and how what they eat impacts others, you know, teachers with students. So they were trying to get that message out. And they gave a few good ideas, these homemade kale chips and these smoothies that are very simple, not many
delicious
ingredients, and very child-friendly.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
I wanted to, I'm sorry, I didn't really get the chance to say hello to Deb.
Hi.
Hello. Welcome. I'm sorry to be here. In the first episode of this series, Everything's on the Table, we did have a segment on school food, and we had invited Nancy Easton.
Yes.
From Wellness in the Schools. I don't know if you heard that segment, but the discussion focused, as a lot of what Bruce was saying, is on the actual food that's being served in the school, and that there's, you know, Wellness in the Schools and other is working with the Office of School Food to try to make more meals, and that's all great. I mean, it's wonderful. That's obviously very key.
Yeah.
And food in schools has improved, but it's still an uphill battle to make some of these broad-based changes. So how does your work, like, dovetail with kind of the efforts around cafeteria food with WITS's work as well?
Yeah, that's a great question, because obviously we are tremendously admiring of the work that WITS has been able to accomplish in schools, and also of what school food has been able to do in terms of offering better, healthier options to a lot of students. The problem that we find is that putting better food in school cafeterias is certainly a good step and one step, but it doesn't really address this issue of a cultural change around health and wellness in schools. And unfortunately, there are a lot of kids, particularly at the high school level, who won't even eat in the cafeteria for a variety of reasons. But even in the lower grades, what happens in the cafeteria doesn't often really infiltrate in the hallways of the school and in the community of the school and the policies and initiatives in the school. And so Food Fight was really an opportunity to try to reach out to other adults in the school, teachers, staff, administration, and get their buy-in so that we could start shifting the culture around health and wellness by encouraging participation of the adult population that typically does not eat in the cafeteria.
So obviously Bruce is, as a parent, he was obviously involved in some of these efforts. And so how do you do this?
Absolutely. It's good that you mentioned parents as well, because obviously, for Food Fight, our first point of entry into a school is often through teachers and staff. And we did that very strategically because we felt that teachers are incredibly well positioned to be role models and change agents in this effort. But they've been largely ignored. They haven't been, for lack of a better word, invited to the table and invited to participate in the movement. And we recognize that if we were going to ask teachers to walk the talk and to be role models for change, we had to address their own health issues first. We had to give them the tools and the agency and the belief that this was an important part of what it meant to educate a child successfully. And so once we got the teachers on board, then the school, with one voice, can reach out to the parent body, because obviously parents have to be partners in this work as well. And that's actually how Bruce got involved. And so once we have teachers and parents on board, then we can start looking at ways in which we can engage students through a variety of initiatives, some curriculum, some programming. And we found that to be very successful in shifting the overall culture of the school.
Okay, so you don't just work in New York City, you're actually national, is that correct?
We are. We're currently operating in about 50 schools throughout New York City, and I would say all five boroughs, but we're having a little problem kind of infiltrating Staten Island. We're working on it. Staten Island, we're coming.
Call us, Staten Island.
Yes, exactly. We want to get to you. But we also had the opportunity from a very generous sponsorship from the Whole Kids Foundation, we were able to bring our program national. And so now we are offering programs in Texas, in Colorado. My colleague, Carolyn Cohen, who is the co-founder of this organization, is currently in Arkansas doing a teacher wellness workshop. So we are looking to expand.
So, your focus is on the teachers and often then through the teachers into the parent and the home as well. Mm-hmm. But do you ever have any relationship with the school food staff? So separate of what is being cooked and working on this level with the staff as well.
Yes. So we actually had a truly amazing and inspiring opportunity to work with Ann Cooper. So for those of you who don't know, Ann Cooper is called the Renegade Lunch Lady. She is really a person who single-handedly revolutionized the way school food operates in Colorado. And she now works in Boulder, Colorado, as the head of their nutrition services department. And she brought us in because what her concern was that this movement to increasing scratch cooking and bringing healthier food into cafeterias actually puts a tremendous demand on the workers there. It's a lot more labor intensive, time intensive, and resource intensive. And she was finding that there wasn't a tremendous buy-in. There was a lot of pushback from her workers. And she felt that this program, Food Fight program, would be really wonderful in engaging them in this conversation and helping them see how their efforts were really fundamental in shifting how kids thought about food and the way food was valued in the community and in the school. And so we went to Boulder and did a workshop for 150 of her food service workers. And it was amazing. It was amazing to see how excited and enthusiastic they were after the workshop and how they felt they were really contributing something meaningful through their work.
But this has not transferred over into New York, that aspect of the program yet?
Not yet. Okay. I think, we are certainly, we work very closely with the Department of Education. We certainly have lots of friends in school food, and we would be very excited to be able to provide that kind of service here in New York as well.
What Do you have any thoughts about what the barriers are for getting some of this really in-depth food system education into the classrooms for teachers in the curriculum that teachers teach?
Yeah.
And what obstacles have you faced in talking with schools?
So the obstacles are not few. I would say, though, when I really try to distill or drill down to what the primary obstacle is, it's not interest. It's not will. It's not enthusiasm, because we get flooded with calls. People really want to do this work. They want to take this on. The biggest problem is, by far, is scheduling, is trying to figure out how we get our program into schools in a way that can be managed, given the incredible time restraints and restrictions that are placed on schools and the demands that are currently placed in terms of meeting the Common Core standards and all the other things that schools have to do. So what we're really finding is that because schools are currently not really held accountable for the wellness of their staff or their students, it's just easy to push this down the priority chain. And so what we need are principals and parents and teachers who are kind of pushing for this, who are saying that this is really important, this is really key. We want to have this as part of our program, because we recognize that when students are eating better, they're performing better in school. And the same goes, of course, for teachers as well.
Now, the Common Core standards are generally a federal mandate, but does the city have any influence on what gets taught locally as far as wellness and foods?
They actually have quite a bit of latitude. I mean, really, the Common Core standards really evolved kind of at the state level, and the governors had a tremendous amount of influence and input in how the standards were structured. And New York City is one of the Common Core standard states, and so we are beginning to make adjustments to meet those standards. Within New York State, there are standards around physical fitness and health, but they're pretty broad. They don't really help to kind of itemize or specify what kinds of skills students really need to know in order to be healthy, in order to protect themselves or to navigate in what I think can only be described as a toxic food environment. And so the New York State really does have, and New York City really has an opportunity here, I think, to be much more specific and to really be a leader in terms of establishing the way standards could look around health and wellness, to give students and schools the tools they need to make these kinds of changes so that students have the information and the knowledge that they need.
Well, you kind of answered my next and pretty much last question about a wish list for school food and health education. You can go on in a minute, but yep. I really want to hear from Bruce. Do you have, specifically as a parent, kind of a wish list, if you will, of what you would like the school food system to look like in the coming years?
I think it would be great if all schools needed to have gardens within the school community, and some of those garden items were used for school meals. No soda, no sugary drinks in school. And just really, I'm thinking that we almost need to go back to 30 years home economics and reintroduce it. And make it really focused on kids and nutrition and helping them understand.
Right. I mean, I think it's this issue of life skills. And Devin mentioned in her segment this notion about it would be great if schools where the default choice was the healthy one, right, where that students weren't asked to choose between the apple and the fries or the apple and the Snapple, that the healthy food options were the easy options. And I think school food has done a great job in moving in that direction. And additionally, what I would love to see is that this educational initiative supporting that, so that we've got good food in the schools, we've got gardening or at least some kind of food growing opportunities, which there are a lot of programs that are doing this, bringing kind of green towers into schools so you can grow inside. Schools don't have gardens. But really, we feel like there has to be some comprehensive, coordinated program for education where kids are actually given these very specific tools. And it's not rocket science. It doesn't have to take away from the Common Core or from the academic subjects. It only augments them and makes students more successful. And if we could write that into policy, if we could make sure that students do not graduate without these basic common life skills, I think it would be, really improve the health, the wellness, the vitality of our students, and ultimately improve our schools.
And an overall knowledge of the kind of how the food system works.
How the food system works, right.
Home economics kind of for the 21st century.
Exactly.
Excellent. Deb, Bruce, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your work.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
We are going to be taking another short break. You're listening to Everything's on the Table. What's the Recipe for the Future of Food in New York City? It's co-produced by the Food Systems Network of New York City and the Heritage Radio Network. Hang tight. We'll be back after a short break.
You're listening to Maurice Narcisse by Yua on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
All right, we are back. You are listening to Everything's on the Table, and today we're continuing our discussion on health. We're joined by some new studio guests. Carolyn, why don't you make some introductions?
Yes, I'm very happy to welcome two of our new guests, Amritza Owens, who is the founder of Harvest Home Farmers Market. Full disclosure, I do sit on the board of Harvest Home Farmers Markets, but her work is amazing. She founded it after working after her work at the Bronx Perinatal Consortium that showed her the nutritional challenges facing low-income mothers. In the summer of 1993, she created a Mott Haven market in the Bronx geared toward pregnant women, and by 2012, Harvest Home has operated 18 markets in four of New York City's boroughs. I'm going to let Maritza tell you a little bit more about Harvest Home and its mission. But I want to backtrack a bit, Maritza, at the what was, if you will, the foodscape at in the Bronx and other neighborhoods where you worked when you first started out? Just give us a quick kind of thumbnail sketch.
Well, at that time in the Bronx, particularly in the South Bronx, there were abandoned buildings, very few supermarkets. If there were supermarkets, the quality of the food in supermarkets was very poor. There was a high incidence of infant mortality, which is why the program that I worked for at the time was funded from the federal government to try to ameliorate those conditions. And so the Healthy Start program actually was one way of dealing with the food conditions in the South Bronx at the time by bringing a farmer's market into the South Bronx.
And now you work in Manhattan as well. You also sit on the partnership with Devon, is that correct?
That's correct. So we are also part of the Partnership for Healthier New York City program. We do our active living program under that initiative. And we also have farmers markets in Central and East Harlem.
Devon, I want to jump back to you for a second. When you did your community survey, you had some very interesting results about though changes have been made significantly in the availability of healthy food, that there is some interesting data from that survey. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I think something that is happening is that we know people do like to shop for fresh produce and like to go to farmers markets. Yet in our survey results, people aren't going to them as often as we would like to see, and that's because there aren't that many of them. So Maritza really is providing a huge service to the communities she's in. She has created such a niche organization and a name for healthy food, really, and for farmers markets within the community. I think she can speak to it more than that. But yeah, the numbers are really interesting. It's that people do want to go to farmers markets, but they're not necessarily going because they might not be there.
Well, Maritza, why don't you tell us, you said you have a very niche kind of market, if you will. What is the mission and approach of your farmers markets, and how do you actually connect the dots for the community between access and consumption?
So for us, our niche has been that we have started providing access to low-income communities. So most of our markets, I would say 80%, 90% of our markets are in low-income neighborhoods. And that's really the need that Harvest Home and I started to respond to back in the early 1990s. And so the way that we connect that with the community is that because of most of the communities have the chronic illnesses that we are all become familiar with, we've started to do things like cooking demonstrations through our Eating for Good Health program, doing workshops around healthy meal preparation, doing play streets with young people ages 5 to 13 to try to address obesity in our younger population. And so we're looking at the farmers market as a way to not only provide access to produce, but to also use that to educate and our residents and consumers about all of these other aspects that have an impact on healthier outcomes.
I understand you also are a participant in Wholesome Wave's fruit and vegetable prescription program. Can you tell us a little bit about how that's been working and where you do that?
Well, that program has been a program that we've worked with Wholesome Wave for the past 5 years on several programs, but this program, the VeggieRx program, was launched this year as a pilot in New York City at two locations, at Lincoln Hospital and Harlem Hospital, where Harvest Home also has a farmer's market. And the beauty of that program is that it actually works with the physicians in the hospital, dietitians, and the WIC program to be able to enroll families in this program and measure their biostats and follow them over the course of the market season, and providing them health bucks to be able to come and shop at the market and see what the impact of them increasing their consumption of fruits and vegetables is on their outcomes and health.
Wow, that's very interesting. So there is a real effort, in essence, to put the missing piece in between the access and the consumption, and that's kind of how your Eating for Good Health initiative started. I want to turn, I apologize, I forgot to introduce you, to Lois Godfrey, who is one of your trainers for the Eating for Good Health program.
Yes.
Lois is a nutrition and culinary management consultant and in the Bronx. And she helps, who works with nonprofits, faith-based institutions, and commercial businesses. I could go on and on about all of the various seniors and children, child care and agencies that you've consulted with, but I really want to get to your work. Can you describe how you work with this Eating for Good Health workshop, you know, where it takes place, who comes, who attends, and kind of its focus?
Okay. Well, thank you. Well, Maritza does all of the outreach and makes the arrangements for the locations where the workshops are held. And by the time I'm involved, there are a group of women and children and sometimes men that are waiting for me to do something. So my challenge is now to come in and to try and create an environment that will motivate them to want to learn and want to apply what we're hoping that will help them and make healthier food choices. One of the first questions that we talk about is, what does a healthy plate look like? In order to get someone to make a change, they need to know what they're changing. And so we said, what does a healthy plate look like? And there's this big discussion around what they think it is, and then we show them the healthy plate. And so the program that that Maritza has put together connects the teaching that I do with the healthy plate and the components of the healthy plate and the actual preparation of a meal that fits the model of that healthy
plate.
So
you sit down with families, you eat family-style meals of healthy food, and then you talk about how this meal helps you,
exactly,
and what the components are, and how to make it delicious,
exactly.
Et cetera.
And one of the things I want to say, that one of the key components of the program is that we invite people to come as a family unit. It's not targeted as just one individual. We want people to come as a family unit. So our workshops, when we ready to do the registration for a workshop, we may have a mother and three children, a grandmother and a grandchild, a male with his wife. So when you come into the room, you'll see a number of people. It's not, you won't just see just individuals. You'll see family units actually represented in the room.
I know that we're kind of running down on time, but I really wanted to jump ahead. I mean, there's so much I wanted to ask you about this this workshop. And but I want to ask Maritza, and actually you too. Obviously, in low-income neighborhoods, it's kind of redundant. The major issue is often costs. And your markets are extremely reliant upon, why don't you give us a thumbnail of the SNAP and other food
subsidies?
Yeah.
So our markets, what makes our markets work are the food subsidies. So we redeem approximately $100,000 in food stamp and SNAP benefits a year. We've redeemed over $65,000 a year in health bucks. So what makes our markets work are the food benefits that the customers receive, because we are in low-income neighborhoods, and that's the driving mechanism that makes our markets work.
I guess to wrap up, I wanted to hear both from you, Lois, and then also from Devin, and in closing, what have been your obstacles in getting healthy information, and kind of what are the priorities that you would set in working forward, that either the new mayor or just in general, what priorities do you have for getting healthy food to people and increasing healthy outcomes?
I think there's still some barriers in terms of consumption of healthy food, particularly when it comes to the competition from the promotion of unhealthy food. I think that mothers, particularly in their small children, you can overhear them say, oh boy, if you stop crying, I'll take you to McDonald's. So in McDonald's and Burger King's are just so available in our communities, so it's pretty hard to get them out of that environment when it's saturated with fast food.
Devin, what is your work plan going forward? Like, what are you going to be focusing on?
We're still going to be focusing on the environment, but also on the education piece and upping that knowledge. And I think the key moving forward, and you said it at the beginning of the segment, is how do we make public health that driving force? People often peg public health as this bully, as the academics, as the researchers, and, you know, I work at a hospital, as the people working in public health at the hospital. But public health is community, so we couldn't do the work we're doing. I mean, we're a partnership. We rely on our partners and our collaborations and people pulling resources together to fight this together. So public health and food, we need to join forces, and we need to join forces with the Department of Ed and with the food retailers and those in the for-profit industries, and we really need to battle this together.
Great.
Wow, I wish we had another hour, but unfortunately we do not. I'd like to thank everyone who's been a guest on the show today, and Carolyn, thank you for acting as the co-host of today's segment.
Oh, it was a pleasure. It was fun.
So obviously lots of ground we covered today. If you want to learn a little bit more about some of the organizations here, I definitely recommend checking out their websites, www.nycfoodscape.com, www.harvesthomefm.org, www.foodfight.org. And then please be sure to connect with our co-producer on this series, the Food Systems of New York City. It's www.foodsystemsnyc.org. They got some great stuff on the horizon.
I'm sure you'll hear about it again, but Food Day is coming up on October 24th. All of these partners here today have Food Day initiatives. You can find out more, I think, on Devin's website about what's going on in Harlem and other parts of New York City.
HealthierNYC.org for more information about Food Day events.
Awesome.
Excellent.
Check them out. I want to send a special thank you to my co-producers on the series, Michael Addison and Caitlin Salemi. Awesome to have you guys on board. Thanks so much to everyone out there tuning in. Please check back with us next week for another episode of Everything's on the Table. This show, like all 30 of our live weekly programs, are available for free. Just visit our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. If you believe in what we're doing, we are a member-supported organization. I hope you'll click that Donate tab and become a member today. You can also find all of our programs on iTunes and Stitcher Smart Radio. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.